I've described to you, at least in words, what the problem is. So the problem is not just, you know, deriving a certain set of amplitude functions, but actually find amplitude functions that are consistent if you do coarse graining. And that's something that we will want to do. So the changing of the amplitudes under coarse graining is what you can think of as the RG flow of the model in question. And that's the, if you like, it's one of the, but I would say it's even the open problem in spin film model that you have to solve before you can actually claim to have a good theory, or to have a consistent theory, which you can say something about continuum limits, for instance. Okay, so in the following we will actually look at it at this problem, but in a very, very drastically simplified setting. The drastic simplification of the problem. It will still be the four-dimensional spin foam model, or one spin foam model that we're going to talk, a very specific one. But we are actually restricting ourselves to only very specific J's and intertwiners. And that has, so what we are going to do is we are going to a truncation of state space and one of the reasons why we do this is that obviously that the RG flow becomes computable. In the literature list that I've given you, the last entry were the two papers where this has actually been done. But actually the RG flow becomes computable by you. So you don't need anything fancy. You can actually do it. Restricting the state space is also nice because what you can actually try to do you can try to limit yourself only to certain geometries. And already here, even though we'll use this simplification, I'm going to tell you what it is in a second, we still have a non-trivial RG flow. The bad thing about this approximation is that a priori... Yeah, sorry?
Can you explain what you mean by restriction to certain geometries? Is that something you do, or something that follows naturally from your drastic simplification?
No, that is the drastic simplification. The simplification is that you're not summing over all of those, you're just summing over certain states. And you might have the idea, for instance, that in certain situations only certain amplitudes actually play a role. So you might actually throw quite a lot of those away, and that's something that, you know, as a test one can do and just see what happens. There's no claim that this actually has, you know, still all the features of the full model. This is more or less, if you like, this is more or less a toy thing that we do now.
But is that a pro, or is that a description of the simplification? I mean, why is this a pro?
The restriction to certain geometries. As I said, because you might want to be in a situation where you're only, for instance, in cosmology, you only would want to look at certain fluctuations. You're really only interested in what happens with a scale factor, and all the non-homogeneous fluctuations you actually don't want to look at. You know, that's a simplification. And classically, you know that GR can do this, so you might think that, you know, this spin-film model might also be able to do this. or if you like, rotational symmetry might be another way of, you know, just trying to implement symmetries from the outset, if you want, for instance. But as I said, I mean, a priori, it is difficult to estimate the error that you do. So as I said, I'm not claiming that, you know, we're capturing all the features of the model by doing this. And in particular, what we will not be able to capture is anything about the fluctuation of curvature. So that already throws away quite a large bit of general relativity. But we're able to make statements about how the diffeomorphism symmetry is treated by the model. So that's actually the statement that comes out of this. OK, so here's what the approximations So first of all, we're not going to look at all sorts of irregular deltas, but these deltas that we will look at will be 4D hypercubic lattices. When I say hypercubic, this is a statement about the combinatorics of, you know, which simplex sits, or which four-dimensional piece of space-time sits where. As I said, I mean, that's not yet a statement about the geometry. A statement about the geometry is the following. That's actually one of the hard ones, is that the truncation of states we will only consider a subset of the JFs and the iota E. Now, these iota E, I've never really told you what they actually are. I just told you, well, there are some invariant tensors. And there's a very nice way of constructing tensors which correspond to certain three-dimensional shapes. And that goes by the name of coherent intertwiners. If you like, those are coherent states which are peaked on a classical three-dimensional geometry, and we're going to take a very specific one, namely the ones that where the three-dimensional geometry actually consists of a cuboid. So again, I'm not telling you how this looks like in formulas. All of this will actually be provided to you in the tutorial. So, but a cuboid, so we have a special form. Of these intertwiners as, if you like, quantum cuboids. So a cuboid looks like this. Remember that we will describe this cuboid by telling you what the three areas are. By three areas, right? And these spins, if you like, are allowed to fluctuate. So you know the cuboid could look like, you know, could be very thin or could be an actual cube. That's something that we'll be summing over. Right. So the third thing, and we've already, you know, touched this briefly, is that we will work in the large J asymptotic regime. Right, so large J practically means that, you know, these J's are very, very large with respect to 1. J equals of 1 means that the area is roughly 1 Planck area, so that's very close to the Planck scale. The large J asymptotic regime depends a bit on the amplitude, but you can think of, you know, this starts at the latest at J like 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5, maybe. right? So 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 Planck length is still, if you like, 100 Planck, sorry, Planck area is a 100 Planck length times 100 Planck length. So these cubes are still very, very small. But this has, so it's still far below anything that you would know, for instance, from particle physics. But it is away from the Planck area, from the actual deep Planck regime. Right, so these JFs, which are usually 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, and so on. Right, so these are then actually very large JFs. So this is large and fixed. And these JFs, if you like, JFs can be thought of as being real variables, like very roughly. Right. Just keeping in mind that if you actually go to JF precisely zero, maybe you know you shouldn't trust your model very much. But over, you know, that's just a very narrow point on your integration range. Right, and that, yeah, exactly. That means that, you know, summations become essentially integrations. There's another advantage to why this large J asymptotic regime is good. It's not just that the variables become continuous, at least, you know, approximately. It's also that in this large J area, the very specific amplitudes that we're looking at, there are actually closed expressions for those. So we are really actually taking the large J asymptotic expression of the Riemannian signature EPRLFK model. So this is a very specific spin form model. It's one of the most popular ones, simply because it's, well, one of the reasons is that it has some very nice properties. Another reason is that it's, you know, it's been one of the first ones. And but there are other models. There are other models, and you know, you could basically think of those. There are some other pathological features of this model that we're not really going to talk about, but which also prevent this from, you know, really telling you something about quantum gravity. But right now, it's more, you know, basically making everything so simple and so nice that it can be done. Okay, so this depends on certain coupling constants. One of the coupling constants is called alpha. The other one is kappa, which you can think of Newton's constant. There's another parameter, which is called gamma. That's the so-called Barbero Emirzi parameter, Emirzi parameter. That's a bit like the theta angle in QCD. It's something that, you know, classically, it's a fact in front of a topological term. So classically, it doesn't really appear, but quantum mechanically, it plays a role. And you could also add cosmological constant, which we're not going to do. But in principle, you can do this. So what do the amplitudes look like? I said these amplitudes are local expressions of the spins and the intertwiners. And this AF will really just be the spin that you have to the power of 2 alpha. The These ones, they are actually rather simple. They are one if you normalize all your states. Otherwise, they're the normalizations of the states. And so these are the amplitudes that you assign to the edges. And the amplitudes that you assign to the four-dimensional piece of space-time, those are actually the most interesting ones. And those are the following: e to the I sr plus 1 over d star e to the minus I sr plus 1 over norm of d, then e to the I gamma sr plus e to the minus I gamma sr. I'm going to tell you what all of these are. So d here is called the determinant function. This is a function of the spins. It's a rather complicated function of the spins, which is why I'm not going to write this down. And sr is a regi like action. And that means it, in particular, is proportional to 1 over kappa. When I say regi-like action, usually when people talk about the regi action, what they mean is in the context of, you know, when you always have symplices. If you don't have symplices, you can still write down something like a regi action. This is, if you like, the discrete version of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So, I mean, we don't have it anymore, but, you know, well, you... So you see that, you know, this piece which you have in the integral, well, it looks a bit like, you know, if here, for instance, you have something which is e to the I, something like regi action, or something like Einstein-Hilbert action. Well, unfortunately, you also have these other terms. I mean, here you have the ones with a minus sign. Here, again, you have the same terms, but without the gamma for some reason. So it's not really what you would think of, but that's the result that you get. So, well, it has, at least has something to do with GR. Maybe it's not so good. It's, as I said, this is one of the reasons why Riemannian signature is a bit bad. If you don't do the Riemannian signature, these two terms, but Lorentzian signature, these two terms fall away, and you only have those two terms left, which is already nicer. You still have one which you don't like. Well, you want to get rid of one of those. That's when you do what people have called the proper vertex, where you say, well, actually, we shouldn't use this vertex in the Lorentzian case. We actually should use the one where you only get one of those, and then you actually have e to the I gr. But here, as I said, we're using this model with this strange pathology. It's unbounded in the sense that SR is something like the sum over, this is the area times some angle, if you like. And this angle obviously is bounded, but this area is not necessarily bounded. So this area is something that... That actually is the angle itself, yeah. No. You actually have the deficit angle of all of these things. Say again, sorry?
That's not necessarily bounded.
No, I said it's definitely not bounded.
It's,
I mean,
epsilon,
this.
The epsilon, not even the epsilon.
You're right, not even the epsilon is bounded.
Triangulation.
You're right. In a triangulation, you have. Well, epsilon, it's bounded from above, right? I mean, or from below. Epsilon can. You can never have a deficit angle more than 2 pi, right?
Well, not the deficit. I mean, even if you take it to not be periodic, it's still bounded if you fix a number.
Well, if you can have, in principle, you can have very large curvature, right?
Yeah, no, I'm saying
Ah, no, but for fixed triangulation, you don't. Yeah. For fixed triangulation, you don't. Yes, absolutely. Because kind of you're gluing together, say, four-dimensional pieces. Each dihedral angle, you know, can be at maximum 2 pi and can be at minimum 0. And yeah, so the angle is actually, you're right, the angle is actually bounded.
So would you write down here, it's already in the large J limit?
That is already in the large J limit, you're right. In the not large J limit, these functions are very complicated expressions. And in the large J limit, it's these expressions which turn out to be appearing. Okay, and since we work with quantum cuboids, actually, you know, each three-dimensional piece is flat, but you could think, well, maybe I glue them together in such a way so, you know, the whole four-dimensional thing is not flat. But as it turns out, when you do the analysis, you know, dynamically, all of these will also be four-dimensionally flat. So these will really bound something like four-dimensional. The vertices will all more or less look like four-dimensional hypercuboids, which you have glued together. So what turns out to be the case is that this will always be zero, which means that, first of all, gamma doesn't play a role, and second of all, kappa doesn't play a role. You could do something non-trivial if you had included lambda, but we haven't done this, so alpha is the only coupling constant that remains. So, as you said, this has lost everything, every knowledge about curvature.
Sorry, can you repeat your argument? What is the simplification that leads to this? It's the restriction in your geometry?
It's the restriction to, if you like, it's the fact that you have the restriction to these three-dimensional cuboids, and the large J limit. So in the large J limit, if you like, you have flat space, you know, you still have fluctuations around that, if you like, but these fluctuations, because you're in the large J limit, are very small. So only alpha remains as interesting coupling constant. But as I said, there will still be some non-trivial features of the RG flow of this model. It will essentially be an RG flow of this alpha. And then obviously what you should do is you should say, well, actually don't take just cuboids, but also take something which allows for curvature, and then see whether the features of this RG flow still survive, right? So whether any features that we get out, you know, you might just be a complete artifact of our truncation, of our simplification, but so far it looks like that doesn't seem to be the case. So we have looked at, you know, more curved geometries, for instance, the one that Giovanni has been presenting. Instead of taking cuboids, taking, you know, these frosta, then you actually have some non-trivial curvature, and then you can try to look at the same thing, and you find apparently very similar results. But still, I mean, this is something which already shows you some features of that result. Sorry, what's that question?
Is there a way of understanding the continuum limit of this model before we go to training? Is this like having flat space-time or flat, say, space only, and then a local simulations?
Yes, so this is, if you like, this is flat space-time. Yeah. Plus there are some local fluctuations of things, which...
This
fluctuations
correspond to local rescaling only?
That's a very good question, and the answer is very, very involved. So I can answer it to you later. So for now, the answer is yes. So the easy answer is yes. It's really just it's local fluctuations of, you know, how you have actually cut up your four-dimensional hypercube into various things. It's actually not quite true. There's also something else fluctuating, but I'm not going to talk about this.
One thing is how you cut, right? But mm-hmm. Without cutting, if you don't cut space-time,
yeah,
you can still rescale locally, right?
No, you can't without introducing curvature.
Well, you can't without introducing curvature.
I understand what this, you know, physically, this model would correspond. understood as
it's not curvature. No, it can be understood as torsion if you really want to, but I'm not going to go into that. Actually, without telling you, I will throw this torsion away when I give you all these functions to work with. They are the ones where the torsion has already been thrown away.
Do you expect some local
population? No. No, not at all. Okay, but what actually is being summed over, it's actually part of a diffeomorphism orbit. That's the only thing remaining that's being summed over. And then this RG flow tells you something about, you know, how this diffeomorphism orbit, or how this diffeomorphism symmetry is actually broken here. Okay, but if you don't want, I mean, if you don't know the details, it doesn't really matter. So far, you can just take this as a, well, this is some strange model which depends on one parameter alpha. And so I'm not sure if I have, okay. And which is defined on some lattice. And it really only tells you something, if you like, about how GR is treating flats, or how this specific model is treating flat space. Okay, and if you were to do this and were to look at the RG flow, you might generate all sorts of new models after coarse graining, but we will actually not allow a general flow, but restrict to amplitudes of the type D. And these are really just parameterized by one number, namely alpha. So what one actually computes here is the RG flow in alpha. So this is really just this one number. So you have a delta, you coarse grain it maybe even further, and you start with an alpha here, then you get a renormalized value for alpha here, you get another renormalized value for alpha here, and so on and so forth. Right? That's the flow in alpha that one can compute. Right, so given so if you want to compute this, so if you want to compute one of these RG steps, so you take one delta and you take one delta dash and one specific value on alpha, for alpha on delta, then the renormalized value alpha dash is the one for which Z delta and Z delta dash agree on a specific observable. Okay, so note that this is a way to project the flow down to this set of all of these amplitudes, right? So if you would do properly what one should do, that which is what Giffre is doing, you take a tensor in its full generality, then you coarse grain, then you get a new tensor. Maybe you try to throw away a little bit of information, but you know, mostly this new tensor, you know, can have arbitrary entries, and you remember these nice pictures with the red and the yellow and the blue dots, right? I mean, all of these are degrees of freedom that can fluctuate, you know. Here, we're not allowing, you know, this our amplitudes to be of any specific form. We always want them to be in this form. We always want them to be like this. So that means that after computing the renormalized amplitude, we're replacing this amplitude by one of those for a different value of alpha, such that the renormalized one and this new one that we are projecting to agree on or agree on certain observables. That's right, that's right. I mean, this is a projection process, and it simply because, you know, if you coarse grain a hypercube, you still get something which very much looks like a hypercube. This projection actually isn't so bad, as it turns out, but that's something that you only know a posteriori, if you like. So, let's see. As I said, you can take different observables. You can take more observables, and that give you slightly different projections, and that give you slight changes of the flow. But they, assuming that you don't choose a very bad observable, so to speak, the flow will very much look the same. Since we only have one parameter, it's okay to use only one observable here, if you like, and I'm already telling you which one to take. So,
You could define a coarse grating in any arbitrary way. You can do something which is stupid from a physics perspective, and then you just have one observable, and then you say, okay, there's always one way to tune your parameter in the model.
Yeah, that's right.
But you're saying that your coarse grating is more than just some random arbitrary adaptation in the system.
Yeah, that's right. So just so with this observable, you see this very nicely. So this observable gives a good... I mean, the projection, actually, you know, the change between the renormalized amplitude and the projected one is actually very small, you know, if you look at it, if you use this sort of projection, which is why we'd like to take it. Okay, so this is the setup. So first of all, what we're going to do, or what you're being going to do, is the variables... we go over from areas, so we're not talking about areas anymore, but to lengths. The only reason is that, you know, this would make it a little bit easier for us to write everything down. So now the path integral is the sum over lengths. Our manifold M is, if you like, one big hypercube, or one big hypercuboid. The boundary data, if you like, the transition, the boundary spins, is, well, you know, we are actually taking not two disconnected boundaries, like in the past and the future, but we are taking, you know, a three-dimensional boundary which goes completely around that. If you like, this is something like a three ball. These are the dimensions. So these are just four numbers. It's like how wide, how long, how deep, and if you like, the fourth direction. All right, so this is what M looks like. So the boundary data is really something like this. Say again? The four-dimensional volume is the product of these numbers. So that's those are.
But this is just boundary data.
That's the boundary data.
Which is the three-dimensional.
Yes, it's the. It's so the bulk here. That's the four-dimensional space-time. It has a boundary which consists of some cubes, and the lengths of those cubes are encoded in those four numbers. Right, so the boundary actually looks like something like this. So you have one cube here, you have another cube here, you have another cube here, you have another cube here, actually you have 8 of those, right? So this is what the boundary really looks like of this whole thing. Right? And this is t, for instance, this is x, this is y, and this is z, and then, you know, by making them all fit together, you can think of how these other looks like. So the boundary state is a more complicated spin network function, if you like. Right.
Now, this is a potentially, I don't know where the signature comes in, but you have a potentially time-like, space-like, everything boundary. What are transitional?
Well, this is a Riemannian signature model, so the whole boundary is space-like.
But there's right. No transition from anything to anything.
Well, either you can think of this as the transition from nothing to something.
Like a Hodge-Hopkins.
Exactly. Or you can just say, well, in the Riemannian case, it's, you know, actually. It's okay to prescribe something on the whole 3D boundary. Okay, so delta will be a lattice of 2 by 2 by 2 by 4 hypercuboids. So this will actually look a little bit like that. So I mean, I can only draw 3 dimensions, but you can imagine how this looks like in 4 dimensions. Well, I don't know if you can, but you know, this is a 2 by 2 by 2. This is the z by 4 hypercuboids, and delta dash is the lattice of, this is the coarse-grained lattice. So these are, if you like, coarse-grained. So that one really looks something like that. Here you just have 2 left. Right, so what you're actually doing is you're doing something like a 4-dimensional block spin transformation. You take 2 by 2 by 2 by 2 and coarse grain them to 1. Well, actually here you have 4 of them, so you get, you know, 2 hypercuboids. Okay, and why does one choose this lattice? Because in this lattice, or in these state sums, one can actually write down very nice observable. The lengths that fluctuate have to fluctuate such that they actually are consistent with the boundary data all the time. Right, so the task that you'll have to solve is, given alpha, find alpha dash. Now, and there's one observable, v, which is the 4D volume of the left half of M in that picture. Right, so what I mean by this is that the 4-dimensional volume of this bit here is what I call V, and the 4-dimensional volume in this bit here is also what I call V. Right, so this is an observable that depends on, I mean, what the actual volume is depends on, you know, how long these lengths actually are. Right, so I've drawn it in a very regular way, but there are configurations where maybe they're not so regular, and then, you know, that V might be very small. Now, of course, due to symmetry, the expectation value of V is always the total volume half, right? Just simply because, you know, because of the symmetry of the situation.
So why is the total volume fixed?
Say again?
Why is the total volume equal to x, y, z, t?
Well, the total volume of the whole thing, you know, the whole thing has dimensions x, y, z, t. That's the boundary data.
Right?
That's the boundary data of my whole thing. So the four-dimensional volume is fixed throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, but that's what I don't understand. I mean, you're saying there's some dynamics inside and that can change V, but how does it make sure that V plus the other V or the other half add up to something fixed?
No, the volume of that plus the volume of that is always the volume of the whole thing, right? And the volume of the whole thing is fixed.
Well, I don't know. I'm just asking.
It is. So the volume of this and the volume of that is such that...
because of your restricted setup. Because, I mean,
yes.
You're fixing the boundary, but not the inside, right?
Right. But it's precisely because of this.
But
this fixing.
Like something that you cannot specify locally. That's a global constraint.
That's a global constraint that sits in this boundary data.
Yeah, it's a global constraint.
Yeah.
So
right.
Will not follow from local rule.
No, you're right. But the expectation value is always the half, if you like. And that's for both these guys and for all alpha and alpha dash. Okay, so V is not a good observable. But this, if you like, this is the variance of V. That actually depends on alpha or alpha dash. Right? So the RG flow procedure that you're going to look at is, you know, you start out with some alpha, compute sigma on delta, which then depends on that alpha, and then look for alpha dash such that sigma delta dash is sigma delta alpha. Right, and this gives you alpha dash. Okay, and then you can try to iterate this process. Because what you actually think is that you're actually not having just this small lattice, but you're actually having a large lattice, and you're making this large lattice, you're making these coarse graining steps of 2 by 2 by 2 by 2 into 1, and then even further, and even further, and even further, very much like in Giffre's talk. Right, and as I said, and then we are done in the afternoon session. You can actually do this. So this flow has a fixed point. Okay, and I want you to find that fixed point. Right? So A, find it, and B, determine whether it's attractive or repulsive. And just to be sure, I don't really want you to compute this whole flow. That might actually take some time. But I just want you to find where this fixed point is and want you to determine of whether it's attractive or repulsive. That's actually something that one can do in very, very few integrations. OK, and what does one actually have to do in order to do that? Well, you have to perform integrations, right? You have to compute expectation values. And if you have expectation values, that means that you actually have to perform the path integral in this very restricted setting. And that's some sort of integration, and that one can do numerically. with the methods that you have. But Sebastian will talk about this in more detail at the beginning of the lecture. Okay, and just to give you a hint, I said find it. I'm telling you that this critical point is between 0.6 and 1.0, just so you don't have to look in all eternity. Sebastian shakes his head, but...
Well, it's a good suggestion.
It's a good... Okay. It depends slightly on what kind of boundary data of X, Y, Z, and T you choose. You have to choose one, but it doesn't depend very much on that. Okay, so that's it, and that's what you might be doing this afternoon, Chase.